You're listening to a stage talk titled Using the Open Source Munitions Portal. This week, we spoke to Joe Dyke and Joe Emmett from Air Wars and Nick R. Jensen-Jones from Armament Research Services. Together, they work on the Open Source Munitions Portal, a database of different munition types for open source research analysis. We spoke on ways to use the tool, their latest updates, and why resources like theirs are important. This talk was hosted by me, Charlotte Ma, on Thursday the 13th of March, 2025, in the Bellingcat Discord server. Today, we're talking about weaponry, specifically munitions identification. I'm joined on stage by the team behind the Open Source Munitions Portal. The portal is a free-to-use tool that aims to provide a key resource to democratize information about conflict and open up access to understanding munitions use. Bellingcat and our wider volunteer team use it frequently. The OSMP offers nearly 1,000 reference images of a variety of munitions from active conflict zones, each reviewed and assessed by at least two munition experts. Key information is provided about each image, including reported location, tentative model of munition, and where relevant, analyst notes written by experts. You can also find guides to munition types, explainer videos, and a glossary of key terms on site. Basically, they have everything you would need to know about munition types on their website. Recently, the team launched the first of a series of articles using 3D interactive models to explain how to identify some of the most widely used munitions, which we will hopefully dive into today. The site has agreements with a number of other research organizations, including ourselves at Bellingcat, Human Rights Watch, and Myanmar Witness, allowing access and republication of their archive of munition images. The team next to me is Joe Dyke, Director of Programs at Air Wars and a co-founder of the OSMP. Nick R. Jensen-Jones is also a co-founder and an arms and munitions specialist and director of Armament Research Services, ARIS, and Joe Emmett, a researcher for Air Wars with years of open source intelligence experience focusing on conflict zones and munitions use in the Middle East and Ukraine. If you'd like to ask a question, please do so in the chat as we talk. And please note, as I just mentioned, within your question, if you do not want me to read your username out, because this is being audio recorded and will be posted on podcast platforms following this session. Okay, I'll be back with the questions in a second, particularly those that you ask in the chat. But first, let me pass the mic to the OSMP team so we can learn a little bit more about this fantastic resource. Guys, take it away.
Okay, well, yeah, thank you, first of all, for coming. It's really, really interesting. We're going to try and keep our talks, like you asked, to 20, 25 minutes. So we will obviously be talking and explaining the site, but we know it's a podcast as well. So we'll try and keep it broad enough that if you're not looking at what we're looking at, you can still kind of understand. I'm going to talk briefly about where the idea for the OSMP came from, and particularly the problem it was trying to solve. Nick's then going to talk briefly about how he and the ARIES team designed the kind of verification and methodology to a certain extent. And Joe then will talk about what's actually on the site and some of the new developments, including, as you mentioned, 3D models, etc. So as a kind of brief background of where this kind of came from, I worked as a journalist in the Middle East for a decade. My last job being chief correspondent for the West Bank and Gaza with AFP, which is a big global news agency. I was more of a kind of traditional, non-OSINT journalist working on conflicts, writing about conflicts, but I never really had the time and accessible resources to learn properly about munitions. And I know that was a thing from my peer group, people that, you know, other journalists working in the world, that we all kind of felt like it was something we really wanted to learn about, but didn't really have the time or the expertise. And then in 2021, I joined Air Wars and set up the investigations unit, and we began using open source techniques to investigate civilians being killed in conflicts across the globe. For those of you who aren't aware of what we do, Air Wars is the world's leading open source documenter of civilian harm, assessing civilian harm claims in countries across the conflicts across the world, including Syria, Yemen, Ukraine, and Gaza. We were set up actually the same year as Bellingcat in 2014, and actually a lot of the techniques that Bellingcat has pioneered, you know, geolocation, etc., we have built into our systems, and the two organizations have overlapped many years. But then when I started doing investigations at Airwalls, essentially I kind of realized after doing a few that I was doing the same process every single time as an OSINT process, where I would kind of gather all images of munition remnants, craters, etc., and then I would send them to one of the five or six munition experts that I knew to review. And kind of over time, I kind of realized this was both inefficient and pretty undemocratic. It was inefficient in that every time I was asking a favor from the same few experts, sometimes they would come back and say, yep, that's a Russian artillery shell, model number, blah, blah, blah. And sometimes they'd come back and say, yeah, you've just sent me some metal. That doesn't really tell me anything. Nick maybe can speak a little bit more to that. But you had a few experts being inundated, requests, often multiple journalists sending them the same images about the same incident, asking for verification. And it was also kind of like inefficient in that I wasn't actually learning or getting better. I was just doing the same thing and kind of outsourcing that every time. And it was kind of undemocratic because I work for Airwalls, and so we have contacts with munitions experts and those kind of things. The vast majority of journalists do not have that. And that includes journalists in conflict zones, journalists in, you know, smaller news organizations, people who are kind of experts in OSINT investigations. So they don't have that that network of people that they can go and check information. And so there really was no resource available to fill that gap. And so a colleague of mine and I basically said, wouldn't it be great to set up an accessible library of munition images that had been reviewed by actual experts? And so that was kind of the idea. And then I called up Nick, who will speak in a second, who I'd known for a little while by that stage. And he is one of the world's leading experts in munitions and was one of the people that I would call up and ask if they could do me a favor. And it turned out he'd kind of been having the same idea for a number of years at the other end of the telescope. You know, Ares have trained hundreds of journalists and researchers and others in munitions, but at the end of the courses, etc., they don't really have easily accessible material to direct them to. Maybe 6 months down the line, a journalist would be like, oh, I did that really interesting course, but now I've forgotten it all, and now I kind of want to come back to that information. And there was nothing in the public domain that's like easy and accessible. Images also, you know, reference images tended to be munitions in their entirety, not how people, investigators, journalists, etc., find images of munitions in the real world, you know, once they have exploded, you know, a particular fragment, etc. And even as like practitioners, experts like Nick, who can maybe talk a little bit more, but the lack of reference material meant that like going saying, okay, I want to check my assumptions. I'm pretty sure that this is this, but I want to just see five other pictures of that just to verify was sometimes unnecessarily time consuming. So from that, Nick and I basically kind of came up with the idea for the tool, which we describe as a tool for journalists, human rights researchers, and lawyers who often receive little training in munitions and have few accessible resources. And the aim was not, and is still not, to turn anybody into a specialist. Munitions, as I've learned over the last few years, are incredibly complicated. Every time I think I've understood a munition, Nick or somebody will say, well, actually, there's an additional new variant. And you always have to be aware of false assumptions and matches. And we do not say that the tool can make you a munitions expert. But what we aim to do is to raise everybody's level up a little bit of understanding a little bit, and to build an archive that would allow you to learn from investigations that have been done over the last 20, 30 years in like an easy and accessible fashion. And so we applied and got a grant from initially from the Google News Initiative and now from the European Media and Information Fund. And we built a prototype, which we launched in 2023, just a month or so after the war in Gaza had begun. That was a very kind of janky prototype. So we then spent 5 months getting in-depth feedback from journalists, lawyers, human rights researchers, and others specifically about how the tool could be more useful to them, what functionalities that we didn't have, etc. And then we built a whole new version. It's not actually the same website. So we started from scratch. And that was eventually launched in June last year. And we see this tool and its evolution as kind of pushed towards more accurate and responsible reporting on conflicts. And we at Airwalls are kind of geared around this mission to focus attention on the full impact of conflict on, particularly on civilians. I'm going to hand over to Nick here, but kind of my last point would be that we still see this as like a collective tool. So like, we do genuinely want feedback, because the things that aren't there that could be really, really useful to people, we also want to know those. So yeah, that's me. And Nick, maybe I'll hand over to you.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. I think probably some of you are familiar with ARIES, but for those of you who aren't, ARIES Armament Research Services, we call ourselves a specialized technical intelligence consultancy. And essentially what we do is provide detailed answers on questions about arms and munitions. So everything from proliferation questions, how did that get there, where might it end up next, to very technical, what we'd call pins and springs questions. How does it function? You know, what are the key components we can look at? So we came on board in part when Joe and I spoke the first time, because we had, as Joe said, received so many requests for the same sort of answers from various customers, if you like, or mostly unpaying customers that really needed sort of fairly basic information from our perspective, but needed it to be verifiable and needed to be confident in the answers we were giving them. So, you know, you can imagine that a group of technical specialists with really niche skill sets, and Joe is very kind in what he said about me. I would maybe push back a little and say my greatest strength is that I know a lot of really brilliant experts in very niche fields. We have a guy who, the example I love to give is we had a guy once upon a time who specialized in East German ammunition packaging from the 1970s. That was his focus. And he would look at the fonts and the kerning and look at when they changed the spacing between the R and the E and this sort of thing. You think, oh, okay. So having access to those people, they're often coming in at a 10, if you like, at full bore, nails, pins, springs, bolts, whatever it is. They're really down in the details. And a journalist or an NGO user or even an independent researcher might need a 5 or a 6, right? And what's out there on the internet might be a 1 or a 2, or it might come across as a 5 or a 6, but be completely unverifiable. So the OSMP in many ways is about confidence. And what ARIES does, I think what we bring to the table for this is giving the user the confidence in what they're reading. So you've got to have the really high level, as you say, Charlie, niche expert sources, but you also need to have some of those generalist introductory sources. And ideally, you need to have something in between. And that was the bit that Joe and I really felt was missing. We thought you could get some introductory training from people like us and others. You get some really competent technical specialty work from, again, us and others. But you really had a hard time if you wanted to get on rant into some of the sort of medium-sized questions about arms and munitions. So ARIES, in contributing to the OSMP, a large part of what we do is the verification process. So we contribute in some ways to identifying important information that might go into the tool. But really what we're doing is verification. So we're checking those images, making sure that they're of sufficient quality that the object, the munition, can be classified, and then formally assessing them through a process that sees it pass through at least the hands of 2 different ARIES reviewers. So sometimes it's 3. If something's really specialized, it might be 4. But generally speaking, if you see something on the OSMP, 2 ARIES technical specialists have looked at it, and they've made a tentative identification wherever possible. We make a distinction between identifying and classifying, and those are 2 kinds of operations that are really useful in arms and munitions investigations. Sometimes people need to look at weapons at a much more granular level. They need to know, you know, for attribution purposes, for example, the make and model and the manufacturer, what country it came from. You know, for forensic purposes, you may need to go even more granular. You might need to match a projectile to a gun barrel. You might need to match a powder residue to a rocket launcher blast, for example. But other times you need to look at things at a much more macro level, and you need to understand, you know, what types of weapons they are in broad categories. So how many air-delivered munitions were used in this conflict, how many guided munitions, whatever it might be. So OSMP tries to sort of give people both sets of data where possible. But as Joe said, we're not pretending that we can put a tool on the internet that makes you into a specialist with decades of experience. Instead, we're helping people walk themselves down that path, and then when they can make an informed decision about what kind of information they might need next. So if you know you only need that sort of macro level classification type information, then maybe you don't need to go and pay a lot of money to consult someone like me to tell you something you don't need to know. On the other hand, if you go down the path of understanding the weapons in a particular investigation that you're interested in, and those arms or munitions turn out to be really complicated, or you need to interpret them in a way that requires specialist expertise, then you at least have a starting point to go to someone and have a conversation with them and explain what you need and what you've already done. So that was the gap we thought needed filling. The verification process, like I say, is I think where we put our best foot forward so that we give people confidence. When you look at the OSMP, you're confident that, you know, there's a small likelihood that there's an error in there. We're fairly confident. You know, obviously, it comes with all the usual caveats. We're doing this from open source material. We're doing this from a distance in most cases. Some of these, there might have been a physical interaction, but in almost all cases, these are done from a distance, from desk-based research. So there are all the typical caveats for identification, but at least the level of confidence is hopefully higher for the average user than it would be if they'd stumbled across the photos themselves. I think that's probably the gist of it in the time that we have, but Joe can talk a little bit about the process that each entry goes through.
Cool. Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm the other Joe. I joined Air Wars in March of last year, and essentially my job is more at the start of the documentation process. So I will be the one sifting through social media, so Telegram pages, Twitter accounts, Facebook groups, to essentially find the actual munition remnants and then add them to the portal with the initial tags before they go to the technical specialists from Ares. I kind of want to start by taking you through the evolution of the OSMP, so where we've come from and where we are now. Essentially, as Joe said, we initially launched in beta in November of 2023, and then we relaunched last year in June 2024 with a sort of a brand new design. And throughout this process, we've sort of been aiming to add somewhere around 50 new munition images each month, and that's allowed us to expand from around 230 to now about 860 munition images. And within these munitions, they cover around 200 different models and types from around two dozen different locations, regions, countries across the world. And throughout this, we've also been trying to expand the categories of munitions. So not just air-delivered bombs or rockets or missiles. We've now been adding tank gun projectiles, recoilless rifle projectiles, and most recently drones or UAVs, such as the Iranian Shahed 131 and 136, or the Israeli Harop that was used by Azerbaijan quite a lot in Nagorno-Karabakh. We've also recently begun to sign agreements with certain organizations, one of them being Bellingcat, as well as Human Rights Watch and Myanmar Witness, to essentially allow us to, we can kind of tap into their world-leading research and investigative practices, so we can use their images from the field, we can add them to the portal, add tags and ID them. And a good example would be one from Bellingcat. You look at the research, different research organizations on the portal. And essentially, when you click on each of the images, it will allow you to look at the original source, as well as an external reference link where you can go to the organization's page talking about the munition. Another feature we've added to sort of aid understanding of munitions is what we refer to as the analyst note feature. So that's when we finish reviewing a munition and Ares technical staff will add information to provide basically greater detail surrounding a unique munition capability. So for one example, might be a GBU-39, one of these ones we've got from Gaza. And Ares added that this image shows various munition remnants, including a fuse well and two nose cone fragments from GBU-39 small diameter bombs. The presence of two different nose cones indicates that these remnants are from at least two distinct munitions. And so not only can we show you what these pieces of metal essentially are, but we can also say something that you may miss is that we've actually got two nose cones. So it suggests in this instance that there might be two GBU-39 air-delivered bombs that hit this location. And talking about sort of GBU-39s, they were widely used in Gaza, which sort of brings me on to my next point, which is how we actually not just document munitions, but try to link them to incidents of civilian harm, so we don't overlook the actual impact of the munitions in conflict zones. And through this process, we essentially usually work with members from the Air Wars team to match munition debris found in a particular location to a specific civilian casualty incident that's being investigated. We can also match images, obviously, we've found from Human Rights Watch and other organizations to their work documenting the munitions as well. And we'll always add an external resource link to these munitions so you can look at the original work essentially as well. The kind of the reason behind adding this is that we think it provides important context, not only of what the munition is, but most likely for people who are investigating, say, a potential war crime, you can look and see who actually may have deployed the munition. So who has that in their inventory? What platform was likely used? So is it an artillery piece, a tank, a fighter aircraft, something like that? And in some instances where we have markings or data panels on the fragments, we can actually look at who potentially made that, who the weapons manufacturer of that specific part of the munition was as well. And we essentially, in doing this, we're trying to help the sort of OSINT community gain an understanding of what the telltale signs of the aftermath of a strike may look like for GBU-39 or a Mark 84, and what to look like, what to look for in the future. But I think, as Joe mentioned, you've always still got to be very cautious and look around for any false positives in this. In sort of recent months, we've also moved beyond just documenting munition images to actually helping you visualize the munitions. We've been essentially creating 3D interactive models of some of the most widely used munitions in conflict zones, which a lot of you may have seen with the GBU-39. So essentially, it will give you a 3D model with extra information around it. And you can click on the model and look at the model from various angles, as well as learn about the different parts and match them directly to images in the OSMP to corresponding parts. And then each of these parts, images that are linked, the certain sections, you can click on them and you can look at the original image, where the source came from, just to gain some extra context around it. And we thought the GBU-39 was a pretty important starting point, as it was one of the ones that the New York Times called Israel's weapon of choice in Gaza. We're also looking at more widespread munitions that are going to be used in the future as well, and working on some other 3D models and different iterations of how we can basically mess around and change with the way in which the model is visualized, and maybe help you compare different munitions side by side as well. Lastly, I kind of want to talk about how the OSMP has become more reactive due to the nature of like the conflicts we document munitions use in. Important incidents occur at on short notice in a short period of time, and they often generate large amounts of public interest. And so where there is this particular interest or potentially misinformation, we're going to try and respond as accurately and quickly as possible, essentially to provide as accurate as possible information about the munitions used in certain instances. So for example, after the strike on Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, in September of last year by the Israeli Air Force, the Israelis actually posted on the Israeli Air Force Twitter account an image of one of the F-15s involved in the strike, and there was a lot of reporting about bunker busters being used, and we were actually one of the first to be able to identify that the munitions hanging off the aircraft were what were found to be BLU-109 JDAMs, which are essentially bunker buster, what is commonly referred to in the media as bunker busters, confirming that. Another example might be the recent strike on the Chernobyl new safe confinement structure, and there was a reported drone strike on that, and then there was a lot of back and forth claims about who had done it. Russia said that it wasn't, that they weren't essentially behind the strike, and often even accused Ukraine potentially of being behind it. The issue with that is that there were images of debris and remnants from the scene, and we matched one of these images to a video and some other images from one of the gantries, the walkways at the upper levels of the new safe confinement, which showed what we found to be an MD-550 motor, which is the engine essentially of Iranian and Russian-made, Russian variant Shahed-136 UAVs, or kamikaze drones as they're often referred to, which would suggest that Russia was most likely the one behind the strike and not Ukraine. And yeah, we've essentially tried to expand that and remain as reactive as possible and responding to it. So we've done other ones when there was a storm shadow strike in Kursk. We were able to identify some ammunition remnants and confirm that a British-made air-launched cruise missile was used inside Russia for the first time by Ukrainian forces. So yeah, that's kind of how the OSMP came to be and how it's moved forward. And maybe in a little bit we can talk about the actual future of where we think it might be going. But yeah, apart from that, we'll be happy to take some questions.
Amazing. Thank you so much for doing a little tag team there and really embedding us in the growth of the OSMP. It's really interesting to hear. Keep your questions coming in. I've seen a few pop in already. I wanted to start just by asking, though, because this is something that often comes up when you're looking at building a tool or building a resource, particularly for open source research, where you find a gap, is the difficulty in getting the resources and the time to keep it maintained and to keep it up to date with the flood of information that comes in. When setting up the OSMP, did you find it at first difficult to get time investment for documentation? How did you learn to balance resources? For example, Bellingcat has just introduced toolkit maintainers to keep our toolkit up to date, and they are doing an incredible job. Before, it was very, very difficult for us to keep up with the pace of different tools being launched and to make sure that our toolkit was representative of the latest open source tools out there. So how has the OSMP team been able to manage that process?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I think when we first set out, we very much said that this was about quantity, not quality. And I think Nick and so I think Joe mentioned that we had about 50 images. Now, that's not actually, you know, by OSIN standards, that doesn't feel like very much, but they each go through quite a very rigorous process, and it takes 50 images per month, you know, is actually a lot of work. And so it's about selecting the images that we think are the most useful. Yeah, I mean, the Bellingcat toolkit is such a useful thing. I guess what we're doing, we understand that like the archive has cumulative effects, if you know what I mean, that the bigger it gets over time and you have the same methodology over time, it becomes more useful and more useful. And but we kind of also as an you know, very much you'll notice there's lots of things that aren't on there right now that we were like, okay, let's start with. We initially started with four munition categories. We've now added tank projectiles, but and recoilless weapons, and then some drones. But like, yeah, there's a lot of stuff. Mines is not on there. There's lots of things that are not. So like, we're trying to like do it well. And I think Joe E always says like we need a minimum of 10 images of a particular munition for it to be useful as a reference, right? Because you kind of want to see it from the same thing from multiple different angles, etc. And so, yeah, I think we're not trying to kind of keep up in that sense. And we're not in the same way that Bellingcat is a like a hub of all of these methodologies. Like what we're trying to do is like build kind of slightly methodically a really reliable and in-depth archive, I think.
Yeah, exactly. That's amazing. We also spoke previous to when setting up this call about the fact that you also allow people to submit images to the site for verification. Can you talk a little bit about that submission process, what you're looking for, and if there's any caveats to content that you can upload for verification?
Yeah, sure. I'll take this one. In terms of, it's open to anyone to submit an image. We do say generally that it should be a decent quality image, so it should be fairly up close to the munition, or the munition remnant should be visible. Ultimately, you can go to the website and anyone can upload them, so long as they have a corresponding source image as well that we can add and we can reference, because part of our sort of verification process, which I was going to get into, is that we try and look for the most reliable sources that we can take munitions from and get as close to the original source as possible. And then we put it through TinEye and Google Lens. We reverse image search it to essentially make sure that we're getting as close to the original as possible. And we're making sure that we're checking the veracity essentially of the image and making sure that it's as accurate as possible before we even start the process of going through the methodology behind classifying it. But it is open to anyone. Anyone can submit. It sends it directly to us. We get an email each time and then we can review it and potentially upload it. Yeah.
That being said, you do have quite a large PSA on your site about not approaching munitions under any circumstances. You mentioned that you get quite a lot of imagery from organizations like Bellingcat and things like that. Where are most of your images coming from? How do you make sure that people aren't taking unnecessary risks to help document munitions on the ground, for example?
Well, I can answer the first bit and then maybe Nick is best equipped to answer like the last part of that. Essentially, most of our imagery is coming maybe predominantly from social media, so different accounts. We search in Arabic language or Facebook groups. We often save them and archive them so we can go back because, for example, the Palestinian police force in Gaza have an explosive ordnance disposal team, and we're often looking and scouring through that. But it's a whole range of sources. I wouldn't say we try and balance it out, but it's predominantly social media, and then we're also in now. We're signing more and more potential agreements with other organizations to use their imagery that they've actually got people in the field who are going there and taking photographs of the munition. But often in the past, we have some images from, I think, Human Rights Watch of US ATACMS, which is a ballistic missile with cluster munitions from Iraq in, I think, 2003 or 2004. So a lot of our images date quite far back as well, especially when we take them from other organizations, but we're trying to essentially get a wide range of sources to do that. In terms of approaching munitions, I think Nick maybe could talk a bit more about the dangers of that and stuff. Yeah,
sure. I mean, I don't think there's too much that needs to be said. You know, I'll give the obligatory safety warning, which we have on the page, which is don't do it unless you're trained to do so. As we partner with different organizations, you know, obviously we want to have confidence that they're not putting their employees or their sources in positions of risk, but ultimately you can only go so far down the chain. So I think the remedy to this potential threat to sources or third order effects that we might not be able to visualize is just promoting good safety practices around arms and munitions. So we use the ARMS acronym, which is avoid the area, record all the information, mark the area from a safe distance to warn other people, and then seek assistance from the relevant authorities, whoever that might be in a place. So at the simplest form, that just means if you see a munition and you happen to be in the field, you stay away from it, you talk to someone competent, and it's really that simple.
Very sound advice. Mike, the spelling expert, asked earlier, would you ever look at creating a similar database for full weapon systems, effectively having someone watch a military parade in Russia and Uzbekistan and identifying the vehicles seen, for example? Is that something you've ever thought about? Is that kind of resource out there that you're aware of?
Gary, do you want me to tackle this or you want to chime in? Yes. We would have thought about that, yes. We love the idea. I think, and Joe probably has some words to say, but in general terms, there's a lot of things we could do with this this platform. We have a big document that we all are very excited about. Of course, it's all about time and money at the end of the day. So, you know, how we prioritize those different avenues for future development, I think, is an ongoing discussion. But as Joe the Younger mentioned, we've already added recoilless projectiles, for example. We're adding new types of munitions that we're looking at, and we're adding more detail on those that are already in there. Going forward, I mean, in a perfect world, I'd love to see us tackle all arms and munitions and then maybe even look at platforms.
Yeah, just really to reiterate, yeah, like it was kind of trying to bite off what we can chew relatively slowly initially, right? You know, in the sense of feel like we've built a really strong database of this, of specifically the munition types that we're looking at. And then, but yeah, like Nick and I have also talked about small arms. There's lots and lots of worlds in which this would be incredibly useful. And the main thing that we did with the second version of the portal was we made it kind of fully scalable, like the structure is scalable. And so that was actually some of the data stuff that, but like it involved some of like stripping back some of the things that we had coded for previously and making it a bit less so that like, yeah, if at some point we wanted to add in mines or we want to add in small arms, yeah, all of that is doable within the portal. And like, I think that would be a really, useful potential thing that, you know, over time would be of use to people.
There you go, Mike. There's appetite for it. That being said, while we're talking about resources, we've mentioned that people can submit. Is there an opportunity for people to apply or offer to help with the verification process? Is that kind of locked away to Ares, or is Air Wars volunteers also helping with the verification process? Is there any way that open source researchers can apply to be part of the verification process at OSMP?
It might be another one for both of us, but I think I'd say, not to be too proprietary, because the point of this, of course, is, as Joe said, to democratize information and get some of this out there, not behind a paywall where it often is. I think the real value in what we're doing lies in the confidence we give users. I want people to be able to look at a munition and know that they have confidence in how that's gone through the process. So certainly there are avenues for people to join Ares and Air Wars. And we're always looking for more talented people with a specific background and skill set in identifying arms and munitions in our case, and in other kinds of open source research as well in Air Wars' case. But equally, I think, you know, it's important that if people attached to this project or end up working on the OSMP, they've come from a really strong background that gives confidence to the user base. I think that's what's more important than the volume. A lot of the tools, I had a conversation with this with a open source intelligence specialist about this not too long ago, and he was talking to me about the sort of different waves of OSINT tools that have come out. And in wave one, a lot of it was all about capturing data, crawling, getting as much material as possible. And the sort of second and third waves that we're looking at now, it's more about refining and sorting through the immense amount of data that's out there. So I think we're quite good at what we do within the framework that we do it. As Joe said, that's a little bit slower than maybe the adrenaline rush you get from jumping on Twitter and firing off an ID that you think you know something. But what it gives people at the other end of that pipeline is that confident result that they can use in a court case or a human rights investigation or a really important article for the New York Times or CNN or whatever. So that to me is the focus. I think where we might expand a little bit in the future, and this is probably in line with what you're asking, is in getting a bigger funnel at the front. So getting more data in for us to process. So, you know, time and money permitting, that would be really cool.
Yeah, exactly. I think I've been doing this a while now, and I can, most of the time I can say, okay, well, I think that's a hellfire, right? But I don't think that's actually of use to anyone in the, like, A, there's a million, you know, number of variants that I might not have understood. And like, what you really want is like somebody like Nick or some of the people from the Ares team who have like real expertise, and to say, okay, that's definitively a hellfire, or, as you know, it's still tentative, but you know, that like the value of the tool is that like the people who are verifying it are not, it's not quite like a community value. Like what we are trying to look into, and I think we've talked about this a lot, is like trying to make the tool more community focused. And we've actually been really open to ideas about that and how we do that. And like how, whether it be more like questions around, okay, well, the community, you know, the thing that the people keep saying we're missing is this, and some kind of process by having that, I think might be more useful. But yeah, like I think the like Nick said, the value is in having certainty that that somebody, the methodology that like two people who've been trained in expert in munitions identification have reviewed that image rather than so it's a slightly different process. But yeah,
I might just tack one more thing on the end there to say that
we really want this to be a useful tool. I think Joe said this right at the very beginning. We want this to be something people use. We're not doing this as a vanity project. No one's getting rich off this. So if this is something that is informing your work as a professional or even as an enthusiast, if there are ways in which the tool can do a better job of informing your work and supporting your work, we'd like to hear about it. That for us is probably the biggest community drive at the moment, is how can we make this tool more useful? Part of that's going to be educating people about it, doing talks like this one. Part of it's going to be sitting down with small groups of specialized professions. So sitting down with some journalists, sitting down with some human rights researchers and saying, how do you use this? How could you integrate it into your workflow? Does it actually help? Like, does integrating this into your workflow make your day slower and not help you? If so, we need to change something. So yeah, we're definitely very open to hearing from people about how we can improve what we're doing.
The very next simple question comes is, how do people give you that feedback? How do people get in touch with you if they do have comments or success stories or things that they feel like could be improved?
There's an email, which I should know off by heart, but is in the about page. I think it's just info@osmpairwars.org, to be honest, like, we're quite open on social media. Please follow us on we've actually had some really good feedback on Twitter and Blue Sky, and people actually saying, really, really interesting feedback, and saying a couple of people saying, oh, I found this image here that looked, you know, like when something happens, being able to use the OSMP as an immediate reference and then like linking it on social media, that kind of thing is really, really helpful. I think we're pretty open to that. There's an email that Joe is in charge of. We'd be very open to kind of social media, Blue Sky, Twitter, etc.
Amazing. I've just linked the Blue Sky in the chat. I did the X account earlier, and Izzy Bakerman has just also commented the OSMP at airwars.org as the main place to email. So thank you so much for that. There's another question from Mike that I want to throw in. Is there a way of seeing known users? So for example, if someone finds a shell that they can see the countries that are known to use that type of munition. You mentioned, for example, you can see the different regions in the tool. Is there a way of seeing different munitions that are used across regions?
I suspect Joe Emmett might want to say something here as well, but I'll jump in by saying that's much, much, much harder than it seems at first blush. I think, yeah, that would be lovely. What I'd love to have, again, in a sort of perfect world, is a really deep dive data page for each of the munition models of at least those of particular interest, which included, amongst other things, information on known users. But that is quite challenging to verify. So because we're, as Joe the Elder said, trying to keep to verified content and giving people confidence in those results, we are probably being a little more stringent than maybe some other sites or resources in really fact-checking everything that goes onto those model descriptions and pages. So it's possible. I think it would be incredibly helpful, but I think it would be a surprisingly large and time-consuming job.
Yeah, I'll just hop in on that. Yeah, I'll pass you in a second, but yeah, it's something that we've talked about a lot and it's not like, so you can do things like, you know, you can search by location specific munition, and that filters automatically. It gets very complicated very quickly. And if you take something like a Grad rocket, like who hasn't used a Grad rocket at this point, right? It's easier in the context of Gaza, for example, where it's fairly clear who is conducting airstrikes. But in other contexts, it becomes very complicated very quickly. So it's something we're trying to work through. It's not currently available, and it's just something that we would like to do longer term, I think. But it's about doing it right. And maybe Joe, you've got some.
I think re-upping what you guys have said that, due to with certain munitions, due to the broad sort of swathe of actors that might be both state actors and non-state actors that might be using ammunition. It won't always be necessarily as helpful as well in a conflict zone, because the same munition might have been used by both sides, or in the case of when there's multiple parties involved in a conflict, all of them could be using the munition. So it won't always be that helpful. If, for example, there's an Israeli airstrike in Syria and you have an Israeli-made munition, it might be helpful in that sense. We have discussed it a lot, I think, as the others said, but it might be something for the future. But again, it's really hard to pin down, essentially, sometimes.
Okay, we've got about 10 minutes left. So if you have a question, get your question coming in now. Just quickly going back to one of the updates that you mentioned you were doing was kind of this faster response, talking about ongoing conflicts. And you gave a few examples, Joe, of, for example, the Chernobyl attack. Have you seen an increase of disinformation impacting your work a little bit with the weapons identification? For example, Bellingcat last year published a really fun article called Oh Shit, 7 Deadly Sins of Open Source Research, because we saw, you know, a trend of people claiming to do open source research not following example rules that we would want people to follow. Have you seen a similar trend in munitions identification on social media, particularly in ongoing conflicts or fast-moving conflicts? And how are you dealing with that within your own reporting on social media, trying to kind of get the word out there that you've kind of identified it successfully?
That feels like one for Nick, I think.
Yeah, I've got some thoughts. You know, I'm going to sort of, right, we're in an information environment that's becoming in many ways increasingly more challenging. I think people know that. I think people are used to, you know, some of the disinformation campaigns that we've seen in recent years in particular. However, I think I will say that on the whole, since I've been poking around Twitter and online communities looking at arms and munitions identification, we've got better as a whole. I think the level of knowledge has actually risen. I think people are less often wrong in a very public way. I know when I founded Ares, that was 2013, a couple of our very earliest clients were some NGOs, and in one case a government, that had made embarrassing public mistakes in misidentifying munitions. And I mean embarrassing in the way that it actually affected the conclusions of their report or their claims about attribution in particular. So bad stuff. When some organizations, NGOs and other organizations that work in the open source space got started, there were some errors pretty publicly in some of their work as well. And a lot of that has been based around, you know, the fact that these groups often start small with a tremendous willingness to assist and jump to conclusions. So I think as a whole, the OSINT community has matured. It's got better at not jumping to conclusions. It's got better at sort of self reflection and self-verification. And the tools that we have to try and combat disinformation have also improved. So I actually will strike an optimistic tone, I think, in answering that question.
Amazing. It's actually nice to hear some optimism when it comes to the range of disinformation out there. So that's great. I wanted to also ask a quick question about the 3D models, because obviously that's a new thing that you've introduced and you've spoken about it a little bit. Why was that decision made that the 3D models was the way to go forward? And what process goes into creating them to ensure accuracy when you're describing the different parts of each model?
Yeah, sure. So we were thinking of the best way to essentially help visualize ammunition, and we thought an interactive 3D model was probably the best way, because you can view every single angle, we can break it into parts, and we can match those parts to real world examples, and then we could add extra detail along the side with it. And essentially the process is, we have a really good 3D modeler called Azul with AirWars. And I will work with her and sort of initial stage. We'll discuss it with Nick and Joe about what is the next munition. So we have a few in the pipeline, mainly to do with drones, we might be focusing on in the coming months. And what we aim to do is to essentially draw from technical documents, the arms manufacturers' pages and their images of the munition, as well as dimensions. So on some of the future ones, we might potentially add dimensions to the munitions so you can get the correct measurements. And we thought, a 3D model essentially is the best way to go to help people understand the munition, because often we'll have images of different parts of the munition and maybe one image of, say, a GBU-39 hanging from, or a Mark 84 bomb hanging from underneath fighter jet in one angle, but you won't always be able to see the full thing. So matching these images with a model will help you sort of understand what the bomb looks like, particularly, or the munition looks like, particularly before it's actually delivered. So before it impacts the target, essentially.
Yeah, and I would just add on that it's also like, I think it's really, for me, I found it really, useful to understand and visualize, but also it's kind of like taking it beyond like, I'll just trust us two munition experts have looked at this, right? It's like, okay, you can also understand if like by linking to the specific images. And so if you're on the 3D model, you can see, okay, well, here are the, and then it takes you back to the original images that we've already classified that are in the archive as that particular munition. So it's taking it beyond like it's an extra layer of kind of openness and transparency around, almost like, you know, here is this model, like here are the images from our archive that match these specific parts, and it helps you both understand it. And also, like, I think for myself, like, yeah, now I see things that I wouldn't have seen before I was working on this project.
I might, if I can, quickly also just say that, you know, Joe said at the very start that the genesis of this project was in many ways responding to some of those challenges that he had as a journalist and later as a researcher, and indeed that I've had as a specialist with journalists coming to me and others. In fact, I can see a few people in the crowd here who field queries from journalists occasionally. So you'll probably know if you have an area of specialty and people ask you questions. I don't want to make this sound like we've invented a whole thing to make my life easier, but in many ways it has. We've got a tool now we can point people to that sort of shows them some of the working. You know, oftentimes, as Joe was saying, he's, you know, as a journalist, without a specialty expertise in the subject, you're going to struggle to get repeatability. You're going to struggle to get confidence in the answers, and you can't really check the working if you like. You just get you go to an expert and you say, hey, tell me this. And they say, yep, it's 1, 2, 3. And you go, great. And you take it as read. And this, at least, is just our step towards showing a bit more of the working out. So you'll see at the bottom of that GBU-39 page, for example, there's resources, there's links to other external sites with even more information and brochures and manufacturers' information and that sort of thing. So I'd love us to keep going that way. Obviously, they're quite time-consuming to make, but if we can keep doing it, then we'd love to just sort of show some of the working so people have even more confidence in the findings on OSMP.
Amazing. Yeah, we've at Bellingcat, we've also found 3D models really help with kind of showcasing how we've determined what munition is what. We found it really useful when comparing airstrike models. Trash Panda, I wanted to really quickly squeeze this question. Any plans for expanding the geographical coverage of the data sets? As someone reporting on conflict in Latin America and the Caribbean, this sort of resource would have enormous implications here. So in the future plans, is there any plans for expanding the geographical coverage of these data sets?
Yeah. I think it goes back to what we said earlier. At the moment, it's restricted to explosive munitions and kind of heavy munitions, and Latin America tends to be a place where there's a lot of small arms, right? That may or may not change if stuff happens along the Mexican border, but yeah. We would cover Latin America if there were like the types of munitions being used at scale. At the moment, it tends to be small arms, and there is some stuff, but we definitely wouldn't rule out Latin America. There's also some other gaps. It's not that we've deliberately ignored certain places. It's just that we've focused on the places where there's the heaviest use of kind of these kinds of weapons. And I was noticing the other day that we only have one image from Sudan, for example. Now that's a place where there's been quite a lot of explosive munitions, and so at some point I would like to expand that. And so there's no restrictions in that sense.
And just on this, I know a lot of our munition images are currently from Ukraine and the Middle East and to an extent the Caucasus, but we are starting to add more munitions from especially parts of Africa. So sort of in the pipeline, we have a lot of images of the MAM-L, which is a Turkish-made air-delivered bomb by the Bayraktar TB2 drone, and that's seen a lot of use in Ethiopia, Libya, as well as parts of Mali and Burkina Faso. So we are starting to expand the geographical sort of range of the munitions we are documenting, but it does take time. And as Joe said, there are certain parts of the world where it's more small arms rather than the munitions we're currently documenting. But again, we'll have to look at that maybe in the future.
Yeah, and just to hop back in briefly before I let Nick speak, sorry, is to say that, one of the reasons for that has been that Air Wars' geographical focus has historically been the Middle East and Ukraine. And so, there are contexts that we don't know that much about, which is why we're hoping to expand these partnerships somewhere like Myanmar, for example. Nick can maybe talk about, the munitions used in Myanmar. They're very unusual and different. We worked with Myanmar Witness to build that bit of the archive because it wouldn't be something that we would necessarily be focusing on as an organization. So that's kind of where you would like to build a kind of more collaborative tool over time. And sorry, Nick.
No, that's all right. You've said essentially what I was going to say, which is, we all have our own backgrounds and geographical biases and the areas that we've worked on. And in many cases where trying to get sort of bang for buck in terms of the time and the funds that we have that are both limited for this project. So we're trying to, look at in some ways the low-hanging fruit and gather as much solid material as we can to put through the pipeline and get into the OSMP and into people's hands. If for no other reason, then as Joe said before, it's important to scale this up and show the kind of aggregate value of the archive. But as we push out into the future, and if you're sitting there listening to this and you've got a couple $100,000 you want to send our way, that would help. But as we push into the future, obviously we'd love to bring on people with different expertise and partner with organizations with different expertise so we can expand both the geographic coverage but also the types of munitions and maybe the types of details that we're giving people as well.
Love that little plug there. That was fantastic. Yeah, there's quite a lot of love in the chat for the plan to expand, particularly in Africa. Subtle Knife says Sudan. Yes. Yuri says, I'd love to see more from Mali, Burkina Faso, for example. And somebody else has said that they can help with Sudan. And they'll definitely email Open Source Munitions Portal now. So thanks so much for that. It's towards the end of the hour, unfortunately. We do need to wrap. I can see people popping questions in still. So if the team doesn't mind kind of staying a little bit just to answer questions in the chat, I'm sure our team would really appreciate that. But thank you so much for joining us today, Joe, and Nick. It's been a pleasure to hear about this incredible project that you've launched and have been working on for so many years now. It's been absolutely vital to so many incredible investigations that have gone on over those past years. And yeah, thank you so much for investing your time there and for spending some time here. I just wanted to mention that quickly that we have in 2 weeks' time, we're continuing this conversation on munitions and identification. And we're actually going to have a talk from a previous Bellingcat fellow called Andrew Mathewson. He actually created a fantastic key guide that can help you identify the most common types of munitions that you might come across, particularly explosive ordnances. You can find that guide on the Bellingcat website, but we're actually going to have a chat from him in 2 weeks' time and digging in a little bit more on the regional differences between weaponry and munitions and what kind of keys and guides you can create yourself or via the community to try and help identify these things. So please join us for that call. Thank you so much, Joe, and Nick, for your time today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, all.
Thank you for listening to the Stage Talk. If you'd like to catch Stage Talk live, where you can ask the guest questions, join the Bellingcat Discord server by visiting www.discord.gg/Bellingcat. The music you've heard is titled Dawn by Newer Self and is courtesy of Artlist.